Good evening and welcome to the first presentation in our 10th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at Western, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the purple back there, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster back there taking pictures, Hai Wan Wan, and our instruction coordinator over in the right, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach and Shaden Pruitt designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight, back in the back, is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight has deep Kentucky roots. His father is a native of Bowling Green, and his mother is a native of Mayfield. And growing up, he was a frequent visitor to the public library and a voracious reader. He enjoyed reading the novels of S.E. Hinton, like The Outsiders, before migrating to murder mysteries and Stephen King. It was at Louisville Male High School, after reading John Knowles' classic, A Separate Piece, that he first began to think about becoming a writer, an interest encouraged by an English professor at Transylvania University. Kind of a Renaissance man, he enjoyed a brief career as a semi-professional soccer player, somewhat akin to the character Gabriel Tour in his first novel, The Barbarian Parade, or The Pursuit of the Un-American Dream, published in 2004. After many jobs and adventures abroad in exotic locales like Paris, France, he returned to Louisville in 1997 to become managing editor of Saraband Books, a nonprofit literary press founded in 1994, which publishes quality prose, essays, and short fiction. When not writing or editing, he teaches in the MFA program at Spalding and has in the past played acoustic guitar in a Louisville band. In 2001, he published his first book, A Fine Excess, Contemporary Literature at Play, which was an edited collection of writings by well-known authors like E.E. Cummings and Edmund White. Reviewers called his first novel, The Barbarian Parade, far more distressing than Catcher in the Rye, but just as well written. It was a KET Book of the Month selection in July of 2005. His second novel, Our Napoleon in Rags, published in 2005 by Igg Press of Brooklyn, New York, was a much darker novel which describes the lives of a remarkable group of characters who frequent the Don Quixote Bar in Old Town, a once fashionable turned seedy section of Montreux, Kentucky. It's a remarkable novel whose characters linger in your psyche long after you've read the book. His newest novel, Ghosting, published in 2012 by Igg Press, is set in Lake Holloway, a crime-ridden, poverty-blighted area in mythical Pirtle County, Kentucky, the kind of place where people often disappear from. To quote the reviewer for the New York Times, Ghosting offers a high-low cocktail of lovely prose and cruel deeds. The reviewer for Kirkus writes, this is a tale of love and loyalty, family and duty, naivete and duplicity, played out on an amoral landscape of drugs and violence. The reviewer closed by adding, this is hillbilly noir as literary fiction of the highest order. And with that thought in mind, please give a warm welcome to visiting author Kirby Gant. Kirby.
Well, it's kind of funny to hear someone sum up, you know, the last 15 years or so of my life. It makes it sound a lot more romantic and adventurous than it seemed at the time. Thank you for having me here. I'm really honored to be back. I was here 7 years ago for my second novel, and it's a wonderful series you've got going here, and I'm just very pleased to be asked back again. The new novel is called Ghosting. 7 years between my last novel and this one, not for any specific reason other than this one was slow in coming. I'm going to start, before I actually talk about the book, and I think having had dinner with a few folks here tonight, there are a lot of questions about the book and where it came from. And I'll get to that. But there's a nice little opening section here that sort of sets the tone. It's only 2.5 pages. And it's something of a prelude. sets the scene, gives you an idea, for those of you who haven't taken a look at the book yet, where it's going, what it's about. Three shadows steal across a field of forgotten seed corn, stumbling over fallen husks rotted to the ground. Three shadows bent low scurry past rough leaves that scrape the skin like cow tongues. Late November, deep night. Misting rain that once hung like fog sharpens into pin needles on great gusts of wind. The loamy mud sucks at their ankles, white breath blooms before their faces, and their bare arms burn with the cold as they surge over the sodden field, wild with trespass. James Cole Prather comes last in line. He cannot keep pace with the healthy legs of his companions. A misshapen knee makes him list a starboard at each step, his excuse for a run an awkward pole-vaulting motion mastered from childhood. He catches up to where his friends still at the field's end, hiding out before the cracked cul-de-sac drive. Their giggles and squally hushes spring from the dark stalks, a tiny crew of the stoned and invulnerable scanning for signs of any human figure, for the infamous caretaker making his rounds, the glint of a shotgun in the meager moonlight. The spectacular ruin of the St. Jerome Seminary looms before them. It's a vast keep, 5 stories high, the facade as wide as a football field is long. Row upon row of shattered, mullioned windows gaping sightless over broken fields. At the summit towers a stone cross. Above that, clouds zoom across the moon like river rapids at full rampage. His companions bolt across the open space and disappear behind a keeling pine. James Cole watches them go as he catches his breath, used to being left behind. He raises his face to the roiling clouds, feels the cold rain mixed with the sweat slicking his cheeks. His eyes close at the simple pleasure, and he listens to the swim in his brain and the thousands of sounds that surround. Wind on stalks, rain on leaves, a broken shutter attacking its hinges, each a note sung precisely for him. By the time he makes it around the pine, his friends are gone. He calls their names softly. Only the wind rises in answer. The basement windows nearest him are securely boarded shut. Above, on the second floor, a single window hangs open not far from the tree's sturdy center, and he envisions the scene he must have missed only a moment before, Spunk and Shady hauling themselves up the weak extended branches without speaking, sneakers grabbing for toeholds on the brick ledge. The rain comes down heavier in gobs. A shiver wrings his body as 3 cold drops shock his neck beneath the collar. Up the tree he goes, boots scrape sliding on the slick trunk, clumps of scratchy bark pulling off in his hands. The climb requires more effort than he had expected, but he makes it to the open window and wiggles through head first. The wet linoleum floor shocks when it kisses him hard on the forehead. They've left him here as well. He can feel the absence around him. The dark is such that it swallows the weak beam of his flashlight. Rain sluices noisily in one dark corner, and somewhere there sings a plopping song, an echo as water taps into deeper water, a melody without resolution. The first pearl of thunder rolls the length of the sky in a gradual motion that seems to pour far into the distance and then return. And there's a stench. The room smells of piss and rot and wet dog. The light from his hand works like an intangible guiding rope drawing him behind its lead. He has been in this place many times before, yet at each entry feels utterly lost, even in some way bereft, his heart in his throat. It has always struck him as the backdrop to undesirable dreams, inexhaustible in its rooms, tangled by puzzling stairways and corridors, often presenting mystical compartments with no function he can divine. In dreams, he has staggered from hall to hall with slow-thighed dogs panting unseen behind him. He has fled downstairs in stone slides. He has been swallowed altogether into the belly of the earth, as if the building masked a portal that led deep into ancient caverns, sculpted by slicked flues and hidden rivers. Now here he is again, and as in every dream, he's alone. But he's not dreaming. What was it the sick man had said just an hour before? There's always something happening. You just don't know what it is. It was a quote from somebody else. He is 23 years old. He has no reason to imagine within a year he might be dead. The serrated butterfly knife folded into his hip pocket is mostly for show. Still, he checks to confirm the blade's there. On such scant assurance, James Cole Prather gropes forward, half blind in the darkness, less substantial than the knife at his hip or the light in his hand, an obedient and guileless spirit adrift from all familiars. So that opens the book. And when I'm asked, the book is sort of dark and violent and is very much a Kentucky novel in its setting, although most of the places that I've named here don't exist. They're mostly I tend to combine places and cities and towns, counties, and then make them my own. Because in that way I've found you don't have to worry about somebody who knows the region you're talking about saying, well, wait a minute, that street's not there, or those places aren't there. You know, it's like, well, you know, it's just like that place. It's not actually that place. Montreux, the city in my novels, is basically Louisville that's been moved around and scrunched around a bit geographically. In this book, most of the action takes place in a county called Pirtle County, which doesn't exist, but it's kind of a conflated version of Shelby County, Oldham County, and Trimble counties. And then there are some allusions, some minor scenes that are out in eastern Kentucky in places that actually do exist, but the geography of the action and these scenes isn't important, so I didn't have to worry too much about sticking close to the way things really are on the ground. The book is about, it's about many things. It's about, one of the things I wanted to work with was in my last two books is I would go out of the state. I have a lot of friends too that I visit and talk to, and it's always fun to hear. I'm assuming most everyone here is from Kentucky or has been at least lived here for a long time. To hear what everyone's idea of what Kentucky is. When they think of Kentucky, they think of, well, y'all got that horse race. Yeah. They think of horses. They think of bluegrass. They think of marijuana growing, bootlegging, that kind of thing. And it got me thinking for a long time before I ever even thought to write this book, but I thought it would be kind of fun to sort of try to hit every cliche about Kentucky living and see if I could turn it on its head. And it's sort of like a book about Kentucky that's for people who don't know anything about Kentucky in a way that I think people who are in Kentucky would sort of see as like they feel like they're going to be in on some jokes. That was my intent. But where did the story come from? The story is all about running drugs, and it's about murder. It's about trying to uncover family secrets in a family that actually has, I think, a real love for one another, but are kind of hopeless in showing it, and they're misguided in their ways of presenting it. Where that came from, I don't know, but I can say where the initial idea came from, and that's what I read. That's why I read this first part, is that after I'd finished my last novel, Our Napoleon in Rags, I started casting around not too long, a few months afterwards, like, well, now you got to write something else. Lots of times I'll start with something, a memory, something autobiographical, and then launch from there if something starts to interest me, something that I've just discovered as I'm writing something down, just this memory. It's like I'll start with something that I did know or that I remember happening, and then my imagination starts to run on from that, maybe the way a certain event could have gone. Where I grew up in Louisville, this would be in the 80s, there was an abandoned seminary out on the eastern end of the city, and we used to run out there, and it was supposed to be haunted, and devil worshippers went there and did their rituals or whatever. All of which I'm sure is not the case, but back then when we all believed it, and there was a rumor of a mad caretaker, and I always thought that was the rumor. The satanic rituals, of course, were real, right? I wasn't the brightest teenager, but But I figured every time I'd been there several times and I'd never seen anyone wandering around, and the place was such a ruin, it was hard to believe that anyone was being paid for watching and taking care of this place, because it was huge and it was just falling apart and it was very, very creepy to run around in. Well, it turns out there was this caretaker, and one night I was there with some friends and he did catch us. He opened fire on us with a shotgun. And we ran out of the second floor, literally jumped through the glass of a second floor window to get away from him, where lo and behold, he had a partner with him who was waiting. As I guess he sort of was just like pushing us down that way. And long story short, you know, all juvenile records are erased once you become an adult. it was a bad time for me and for my friends. But so that was a pretty intense experience. And as I've gotten older, I always thought, well, I'm going to go back and write about that night, you know. So I started to, and then the initial idea was it was going to be in the first person. And it was just, I didn't know where I was going to go with it. I thought I could just write about it, what I remember of that night, and then just try to form it into an interesting story that would almost be like a coming-of-age story, I guess. I wrote the first version of the book was a short story. As was the novel before that. I thought I could get it done in a short story, and I was never satisfied with it. I set it aside for a while and would go back to it, work on some other things, go back to it, and I began to see the different hints of a story around what I ended up with when I first wrote my memories of that night on paper. It's really hard to, I think, explain to someone who hasn't gone through a process itself. I mean, David Bell, a fine writer himself, and Molly, you probably know what I'm talking about, where it's like you just have this idea, you've discovered something on the page that suggests there's more to it than what you're aware of when you actually wrote it down. When I think of a prime example of a famous novelist explains how this worked for him was William Faulkner in The Sound and the Fury. He wrote, which is a very weird and complex novel that takes in entire generations of families and history. But he began writing about a little girl climbing a tree, and her brothers are down below, and she's looking in the second floor of a house where they're holding a vigil before a funeral for, I think it's the grandfather or someone who has died. And the boys are looking up, and they've all been outside playing, and her drawers are dirty. He had that image that he was writing about, and that became this huge novel. He had to explain who had died. He had to explain why the kids were outside rather than being in the room with the rest of the family for this funeral, how she got her drawers dirty, that sort of thing. And next thing he knew, he was writing a novel. And that's sort of how this thing opened up to me, is I would have these little asides as I was writing the story version that would suggest this larger world outside of, like, why is this character? I didn't necessarily, it was just I. It was just first person I. And I found myself getting stuck with, why would you go to an old abandoned seminary at night? You know, what were you going there to do? You know, I never thought about it back then, and it was just for kicks, basically, and to make yourself scared. But I thought, well, that's not much of a story. So why is this guy here? And there would be allusions to someone who is missing. And after a bit of time, I made that the character's brother. So then I started beginning to think of, like, well, why is the brother missing? Why doesn't this guy know why his brother is missing? Why does he equate his brother with this abandoned seminary? At this point, I found there were things I needed to figure out. There's a story to pursue. Then his life has a way of sometimes eerily reflecting whatever, when you're really focused on a work, I've found in a long narrative. My own brother, who is nothing like the brother in this book, and I wouldn't say the main character of this book is based on me at all either, became very ill with leukemia. And he fought it for a year and didn't beat it. He died. And so the book's dedicated to him. I think that experience, as I tried to write the book and continue to write the book while he was going through the hospital treatments, that sort of thing. But it was more like sketching ideas of what was going to happen rather than actual page-by-page writing. The main story of this book has to do with For those who haven't read it, this older brother has disappeared with the season's harvest of marijuana for the local drug dealer. And the brother, who is the main character here, the younger half-brother actually, and the community, they don't know if he got away with it and has disappeared on his own, and so they're never going to hear from him again, or if the drug dealer and his cronies got wind of what was going to happen and they managed to stop him and had him killed. And so he, for a variety of reasons, takes it upon himself to find out what happened to his brother. Basically, he ends up having to take walk into his brother's life, what he thought his brother's life must have been like, to get to the point of having the access to make the same choice himself. It's almost like he gives up his own thoughts, his own plans and dreams for his life to live out his brother's in order to find out what happened to him. That's the main storyline, but there's a lot of other stuff that goes on the side. One of which, it's always fun trying to figure out, the book is dark and brutal, as I said. There's some pretty nasty scenes, there's some ugly things that go on. And I always have a fun time trying to figure out, like, when I see the crowd, what should I read? You know, a lot of times I just read from the beginning, the first chapter, not the part that I just read, but the introductory chapter that sort of sets up some of the characters. Basically, it flashes back to what happened just a few hours before those three pages I just read to you. You know, I don't want to offend anyone. It's basically what I'm talking about here. It's like, if it's a younger crowd, I know some sections I can read that everyone will be like, oh yeah, I know those people. If it's maybe a nicer, older crowd, then I'll read maybe some of the more relaxed sections. And now I'm looking out here, and my wife's with me, and we're both like, well, you've got a pretty good mix of both. So I'm going to read, it just comes directly in the middle of the book almost. And what I like about the reading this is it's fairly short. One thing I hate when I go to readings, which I go to a lot, not my own, but others, is when people who read for like an hour or something. And I'm just like, wow, this is so great when you're in the first 5 or 10 minutes. And then after 15 minutes, you're like, man, they're doing great. And after about 30 minutes, you're just sort of like, oh my God, you know, I know. What's the storyline again? This is just a few pages in the middle, and it has nothing to do, or the character, from the point of view of a character named Shady Beck. She's a friend of the main character, James Cole. She used to be the girlfriend of the older brother. James Cole would like her to be his girlfriend, but she's kind of out of his league, I guess you would say. She's from a wealthier family. She comes from a very comfortable life. James Cole and his brother come from an area where the people are called Lakers, and they just it's more of a lawless area. In this county, Pirtle County, that I've created, these areas, these pockets, are really crammed together very close. So you can have a pocket of a neighborhood that's pretty rough and tumble, kind of ignored by the police, and then, you know, within half a mile you're in a very wealthy area of nice bedroom community, farmland, that kind of thing. She's from that side, and she has sort of just situated herself into the story, helping Cole out. And she has a bit of a, I wouldn't say it's a drug problem, she likes to sample a bit. And so I'm going to read about a night of hers. Not real often, but sometimes Shady likes to get high alone. At night, alone, not doing anything else, and she's not going to call anyone or get in the car to wake up a girlfriend because she's lonesome. Just some time alone in her room with the window open, preferably on cold winter air, but any time of year will do. Like now, nearly April, and with March this year holding winter longer than usual, and with the porch light below her window lending the only light to her room. The type of light is important. Smoking up in a bright room isn't the same. Her father has his martinis, and her mother her Librium and Klonopin. And Shady doesn't think that choosing a bowl that she doesn't even smoke every night, not even once a week, unless she happens to have a whole lot on hand, which isn't often. In fact, it's almost never that there's more than a dime in her underwear drawer, and even less in her purse. She doesn't think it's any different from what either of her parents do to relax. She's not a wake-and-bake kind of girl. She's not high all the time, nor does she allow it to run her life. She doesn't even really do any other drugs, doesn't even like to drink, particularly. The occasional pop of X on nights with friends, clubbing back at school. But that was nearly a year ago now. But late, and when she's alone, and it's so quiet in her neighborhood, if it can even be called a neighborhood. The properties are all so large that it feels like the middle of nowhere at night. And her parents are asleep. She likes it like nothing else. She likes how good Pot, when she's alone and in this certain frame of mind that seems to come only late at night, seems to open her to certain avenues of thought she doesn't have otherwise. And somehow having the room dark, except for that soft porch light outside, encourages this. She likes how she kind of slides into self-conversation about her current place and moment in life, where she is, where she's going, the kind of questions she tends to avoid because they make her all anxious. She looks over the trees out front and thinks, "Where are you going, Shady Beck? What will you do, little girl?" Like the doing so allows her to almost touch on some special knowledge or insight into secrets she may be keeping even from herself. Maybe it's only that she's relaxed and it's quiet with that feeling that the world's asleep, and soon she will be too, but not quite yet. A sort of meditation slash prayer routine. And she's high. When talking about this with her girlfriends back in school, they decided it's something like what Indians used to do, maybe. She calls these little sessions her dream routines, and often that's just how it feels, like she's dreaming, but awake in it, and it's good, and as she looks through her window at the darkness out there, there are only a few distant house lights visible, mostly it's trees. She can be filled with such an overwhelming love of life and the world, even as she comprehends that she doesn't understand any of it. Something happened during her routine several weeks ago that haunts her. There's a small TV in her room, and she had smoked up after watching Letterman, who she doesn't care for much, but this TV doesn't have cable, and there was nothing else on, and even though he's kind of a dick, Letterman sometimes can make her laugh. She turned off the TV before the musical guest played. She opened the window and took two deep hits off her pipe. It was this strong stuff Spunk Gruel had given her that night she had been running around with him and Cole at the abandoned seminary. She thought it special stuff and had been holding on to it, parsing out only small amounts to herself. Everything felt fine as she entered her little dream routine, and there was no wind outside, and she admired the single pine among the hemlocks in the yard standing straight and strong like honorable, dignified sentinels sworn to protect the house. She felt fine, excellent even, but soon got sleepy too, and so lay back on her bed with the window open, protecting herself from the cold with the duvet wrapped around her, this luxurious thing filled with real goose down. She'd missed its warmth and felt guilty for missing it the night she stayed under the threadbare quilt at Cole's house, and looked at the dim bluish rhomboid of porch light on the ceiling and part of the wall. That's the last she remembers. Later, she's unsure how much later, unsure how long she was out, she awoke in complete terror. The room no longer felt like her room, and it was filled with this incredible dark, a dark like she had never seen or experienced before, a dark like the deepest cave at the deepest bottom of the sea. It wrapped her up in this mass of dark that light could never penetrate. And even more frightening was the realization that it was impossible to move. Her arms and legs had become unresponsive. She could hardly feel them. She had never felt such an absolute fear like that moment before. What made it worse was that she couldn't understand why she felt so afraid. She was safe at home in her own bed. It seemed that the room had been taken over by this pure cancellation of life, which what little part of her mind was working at the time interpreted as evil, like evil as a pure element. It was so dark she couldn't see the digital clock on the bedstand. She didn't know how long she'd been asleep. Though she couldn't move her head, the position she woke up in allowed her to see the television set, and there the screen gave off a peculiar, horrifying glow, soft and dim but perceptibly radiant. Like the glow that comes up immediately after a TV set is turned off, except this glow was the negative of that, a glowing darkness, and it did not die down, but instead grew forward and unfurled into the air like the way water spills into fabric, the glow being water and the air fabric. This glow, from what she could surmise, fed the heavy darkness that kept her paralyzed. There was no more light from the porch light, no discernible air. Her room had become a coffin stuffed full with this black stuff, this evil stuff that seemed to want her, to want to erase her. Her mind raced in a panic she didn't know she had the capacity to feel. On the bent antenna above the TV, she had hung a necklace of charms, tokens and gifts she had added over the years as she picked them up. A heart from her mother, a broken coin from Fleece Skaggs, a small silver cross bought for her by Brother Gil Ponder from a tiny gift shop inside his church, her, quote, emblem of gratitude given for attending a second Christ World Emergent service. The cross dangled above the area that was filling up with dark, and she concentrated on that. The sight of it seemed to snap the entire situation into focus. She understood that this was a religious moment, having to do with her very soul, that something demonic was making a play for her soul. An idea she would later find difficult to sustain as credible. She had studied biology. She was a scientist. But at that instant, it made perfect sense. Instinctively, she began to pray. She started to pray manically, nothing formal to it, just started to repeat over and over that Jesus is our Savior, and He is my Savior, and I accept Him in my heart, and therefore, whatever that was streaming out of that television set had no claim on her. It could not touch Shady Beck. This did not seem to work. She became yet more terrified. Terrified like she imagines she would be to find herself strapped down naked on a table with a room full of men she couldn't see except for the glint of light off their scalpels. Or more precisely, like being tied down to railroad tracks and you can only watch the train's spotlight grow as it speeds nearer and nearer, your head's vibrating on the rail with the rhythm of the wheels turning closer, and here comes the thundering noise. The darkness vanished the instant her ceiling light flickered on. She found her limbs and bolted upright. Her feet slapped the floor. She found her mother standing in the doorway in a thick flannel nightgown, puffy and dull-faced from pillated sleep, and half inside the room, her hand on the light switch. "You were whimpering," she said. "Bad dreams?" Shady didn't know how to answer her and so said nothing. She looked at the television set. With the whole room bright again, it looked like a normal TV set. Her mother was still standing there in the doorway, so Shady mumbled something like, "Yeah, it must have been bad dreams." And after flashing one of those, "I worry about my little girl, but I'm exhausted" faces, a face Shady has provoked often enough to recognize easily, her mother left her alone. But in fact, the state of dreaming seemed the exact opposite of the experience. It did not feel like some weird post-hypnagogic state either, though she considered this possibility and read up on it. She does not consider herself an irrational girl prone to wild imagining. Naturally, and despite the intensity of the terror, she assumed the pot had something to do with what had happened. She intuited, however, that the pot wasn't the only factor involved here. Contact of some kind had been made. The problem was that she didn't know what it was that was contacting her, what it signified, what it was trying to say. Perhaps because the pot came from Spunk, and because of her eye falling upon the broken coin given to her by Fleece, hanging next to Brother Ponder's silver cross, she connected this experience to Cole Prather. A warning to her? A warning to warn him? It all felt so mysterious, and yet the more she weighed that night in her head, the more certain she felt she had been open to something that was linked to Cole. She wanted nothing more to do with it and made a point of not thinking about it for several days. She tried to put the event behind her and stayed away from the routine for a while. Yet, after a time, once the immediacy of the terror had softened somewhat, and after she had not seen or spoken to Cole in weeks, the strangest thing began to occur. It was almost like she wanted to experience that night again, like she longed to feel it again, to be tempted toward that darkness again. As a way of understanding, perhaps to hear the warning more clearly. So she's been returning to the entire procedure with the greatest precision she can manage. She tries to set it up exactly as it had gone down that night, hung her necklace on the antenna, smoked off a bowl, endured Letterman and his buddy Paul trade jibes, turned off the TV before the musical guest appeared. But she sleeps through the night undisturbed. She has now repeated the process more times than she cares to count, trying to recapture the greatest terror she has ever experienced, practically making a ritual out of the steps she can remember, practically inviting that bad, evil, negative element to return to her room so that she might find what it meant, what it wanted from her, and what she might find in it to bring to Cole. Yet these nights at home disappear in the peaceful sleep of the oblivious. Paradoxically, that she doesn't seem able to make the event reoccur has led her to believe more fervently in the reality of that night, that it was not simply the strength of Gruel's home-batch weed working on her subconscious, but that evil is real, an element as real as positive energy, at least, and it is capable of engaging a person, body and soul. And it's like you can just bump into it, accidentally. Lately, she discovers herself doing the most menial thing, driving alone, or checking in at the new job, or standing in line at the quick stop. And in her mind, she's picturing this entire other galaxy, an entirely separate dimension even, encompassing this world, like a vision out of some medieval fantasy, where there is a perpetual war going on, or at least a yin and yang push-pull conflagration of good versus evil, absolute energies the human mind can only conceive of as demons, and warrior angels going at it in this spinning, tornadic vortex for the, what, the souls of each of us? Admitting this makes her feel kind of ignorant and superstitious, or plain silly, which is not how she likes to think of herself. But if she looks at it from a certain angle, she can frame it as a kind of gift, too. For whatever reason, she has been presented with a brief glimpse into what is actually going on out there, just out of sight. If she's interpreting it correctly. An acknowledgement she finds even more disconcerting, and so she tries to avoid that one too. What if the warning was for her? How would she even know how to heed it? But she feels this isn't the case. If it's a warning, it's not for her, it's for others. The prophets in the Bible underwent such experiences that were meant only for them to share with the others who could not see what they knew. But again, Shady thinks the entire notion is silly. She doesn't live in the world of the Bible. That world ended a long, long time ago, didn't it? Thanks. Does anybody have any questions or concerns? I hope nobody was offended by any of the material tonight. Yeah. Believe me, for those who haven't read it, it could have been much worse.
Also, where do you get the names for your characters? I mean, there are Fleece and Shady and kind of intriguing
and
kind of characters.
I have sort of a fetish for names in books, and I'm often disappointed by how regular names. There are plenty of other writers who don't. I don't think put the weight on them that I do, but. You know, going back to Dickens, at least, and even Dostoevsky's names, if you translate them, the names often suggest something about the character that they depict. As I said, this was a very consciously a very Kentucky novel, so one of the things that I do often is I collect obituaries. My wife and I live right beside a very old cemetery in Louisville, and it's a beautiful place, and I like to walk through that. And there are just all kinds of great names of names that have fallen out of fashion, I suppose, that also seem very, to my ear at least, very deeply rooted in this area. So I just write down lists and lists of names that I like, and you know, first, middle, and last names, and then I'll just start mixing them all around as I need them. Like the drug dealer's name, his last name is Gruel. You know, he's a little mealy-mouthed when he talks because he's suffering from a disease, but also just the idea, the image of Gruel sort of kind of captures him for me. There is a pastor in the book whose last name is Ponder. That's a legit, you know, that one's sort of, you know, obvious. But that's a legitimate last name. Believe me, I looked it up. Prather's last name of the family. To my mind, that's just a very, very common Kentucky name. There's a lot of Prather figures all over the state, as is Skaggs, one of the other family names. So I go about it that way.
Do any of your characters jump in and take right over?
Yeah. Well, actually, no, until this book. I usually have... It's usually such a struggle to get them to do anything. You know? It's like nobody takes over at all. I'm just begging them to. But in this book, I have two characters that really surprised me and started running away with the book as I was writing it. the way I write is I try to write down everything that comes to me. Any hint of a story that I get, or a hint of an action, a history of a character, I go ahead and write it, because I have such a vague idea of where a novel is going that I'm afraid I'm going to lose something that might have been important. And then once I finish a full draft, the process becomes figuring out what needs to be in there to tell the story. For example, this book is, I think, like 288 pages printed. I think in manuscript that would make it like 330 pages. But my initial draft when I printed it out was about 800. So there are two characters in here, though, that really started to run away with it. And that was the main drug dealer character, Lawrence Gruel. He was so much fun to write. And I don't know if, you know, you always wonder if like all your characters are really just different aspects of you, and you know, you're just, you know, it's like the places in your psyche or whatever, but he just doesn't care. I mean, he gets the biggest kick out of causing problems for everybody. He just has no conscience at all. He understands how wrong that is, and it thrills him in a way. So he also spends the entire book, practically the entire book, he's dying slowly. And so he's just enjoying setting up all these people around him for the crap they're going to have to deal with because of him after he's gone. You know, it's like he gets a thrill out of it. Just the stuff he would come up with to say, and then also trying to figure out how he came out the way he did. I was going back into his past, that sort of thing. He almost ran rampant and almost became his book. And then, on the other hand, the mother to the two boys, Lida Skaggs, was another one who, she was very, very strong, but also very vulnerable at the same time. She has an awful addiction problem that she's aware of, and she's aware of, but she's fine with that for now, if that makes sense. And I've just found her very confounding and just endlessly interesting, too. She's also a prime motivator for a lot of the actions in the book. I was fascinated by her, and she had a long section in the initial draft of the book of well over 200 pages, and almost became a Lida Skaggs book, you know. And then I was like, well, I'll make it a trilogy, and you know. And then I was like, no, okay, calm down. So, but yeah, those two characters both, and I'd never experienced that before. It was just like, well, wait a minute, I thought I had, because I was well into the book by that point, 150 pages or so of what I thought was pretty much the prime storyline. And then I was like, well, I need a better handle on these two. And the next thing I knew, I was just like, oh my God, where am I going with this? I don't know, but I'm having fun. And they almost took the whole thing over. And I felt very lost for a while, because I was like, well, what is absolutely necessary? I try to boil it down to what's absolutely necessary to tell the story. Otherwise, I've read a lot of great 500, 600 page novels that I thought, man, what a great novel. What a greater novel it would have been if it was 200 pages shorter, you know. And I hope no one says that about a book that I write. That's something I'm very conscious of. So I try to boil it down as to the absolute least you need to know. And I also like to think that if you know all that stuff that you learned in the draft that you cut out, a lot of that information still comes through, I don't know, intuitively or unconsciously or something. Because I feel much more confident in everything that character says now, or everything that character does, because I just feel like I know them that much better.
Other questions? Molly.
Since we have so many students here, can you trace your history as a writer, how you became a writer, and
well,
what you tell young writers?
I won a contest in first grade. there was some poetry contest that was countywide, and I wrote like this six line poem that won.
Did you say Jefferson County?
Yeah, in Jefferson County.
Did you
ever
make a book out of
this? This is probably a long time ago. I don't think we were making books for anybody back then. No, I'm sure it was done like in crayon on a poster board or something. It's actually just kind of a family joke that I won that, but because now that I write, you know, this is sort of like, well, we should have known back then. My family, I was brought up to be a reader, And it was always a big treat in my family to go to the library on the weekends, and my mother would allow us to, my brother and I, to take out any book we wanted. And it was always a big treat. Books were always something that were of value for us. Even though I had, as Brian alluded to earlier, I had a lot of other interests in music and sports, I've always loved books. And I always thought the idea of being a writer was cool. You know, to be honest, I just thought when I go into bookstores or the library and you'd see the spines and you'd see someone's one name and like all these different books that they wrote, I just thought, wow, you know, that's got to be such a great feeling to do that. And this is like when I'm 12, and I would have no idea how one would even go about it. And I can remember too, which is actually kind of funny nowadays, I can remember too, like going to this one bookstore and then a few weeks later going back to that bookstore, and you'd see like the same book and the same author, and you could tell like the book hadn't been moved, you know, like there were like three copies there, and those same three copies were there, and I would be like, how do they make a living? You know? And I was like, they must, because look at all those books. All these people are writing for a living, but I'm just sort of like, huh, I guess they're just not selling real well here. Now, I've since been disabused of that fantasy. But and I just was always just a big reader. And really it was, I read indiscriminately as a kid and a teenager. And then in high school, reading John Knowles' A Separate Piece, which was standard reading at this time for like freshman and sophomore year. I don't know if people still read it or not. Does anyone know the book? John Knowles, A Separate Piece. Yeah. Wonderful book. It was like one of the first books, I guess for me, it was my version of The Catcher in the Rye, which for some reason I didn't read when I was supposed to. I didn't read it till I was in my early 30s and completely missed the point. It's like, I think it's a book you have to discover at a certain age. But A Separate Piece has a similar, it speaks to a young person. It's about an older man remembering a high school friendship during World War II. I just thought it was the best thing ever. And thought, man, I would love to come up with a story that is as powerful as that one. And as a musician, I was writing song lyrics. I read a lot of poetry, that kind of thing. And it just sort of, I knew that prose was what my main interest, but it wasn't until I was in a senior in high school and then into college that I actually started giving it, you know, trying to figure out how, like reading books with the idea of like, how did, this book was cool, how did, you know, why is it cool, you know, what is it about this story that I think is better than the last three books that I've read, and just trying to like take a book apart and see how it works, and then meeting a professor in college who actually already knew that stuff and could show me, and we could talk about it, and then it just started going from there. Also injuries. As a soccer player.
I wonder this as I read your book. Do you ever interview any persons to find out some of the excursions that have happened? And what made me think of that was, for 10 years in Central America, where you have such a mixture of cultures, so many, some funny, some horrible, some astounding experiences. When these things happen to persons who do not have their parents, they die out. Mm-hmm. But there are so many wonderful things that have happened to so many people that you could come up with novels.
After novel, after novel, after, yeah.
Because you have a wonderful way of expressing and putting people on edge until you... the phone rings, and then you've got to answer the phone, and oh, I can't wait to get over this so that I can get back. There's something about your talent that is unusual. I have rarely read something that got me that excited, and I wanted to cut out everything else and keep on going.
Wow. Thanks.
What about the nature of researching a book like this?
Well, a book like this... I've never gone out and done formal interviews. A lot of it would be talking to friends of friends. Some of the stories in here are family stories and like extended family stories. One of the biggest things that I had to do research on, I wanted to keep it realistic. And one of the storylines here that I literally knew nothing about was the actual underground economics of how marijuana is cultivated and shipped from one place, prepared, shipped, and distributed. And that was something that I just did a lot. You know, Google is an amazing tool. And there, I found like interviews with prisoners, but also a lot of DEA reports, that kind of thing. And fortunately, too, the book is set about 15, 20 years ago. A lot of the stuff that was being done then, I'm sure people go about it differently now, because these are the known ways that it used to work. So it's like, for the period it's in, I know that it's very realistic. I don't know if that's how they would do it now, but that kind of research. I've always wanted to go interview interesting people. There's a policeman at my coffee shop that I go to that I've always wanted to just go up to him. It's like, hey man, can I just go ride around with you guys sometime? You know, what does that entail? What could be, just to be curious to see what, you know, that my city is like from their eyes, because I know it's completely different than my nice little Highland neighborhood. It's like the artsy community, the old buildings and stuff like that, little boutique shops. But I know there's a lot more into the city than that. But I've never done like formal interviews. Like, okay, here's someone who I know does this. It's more like a friend of a friend, and I have a friend whose uncle actually did time as a grower in Eastern Kentucky. And he doesn't like to talk about it. He's born again, that sort of thing. But I asked my friend, could you ask him these, like, you know, four questions and see if he'll answer for you? And so he did, and then he would say, this is what he told me. So I'd be like, okay, those are four details that I know are going to be right, you know, that kind of thing. And then you start to, like, imagine off of that, like, also just the, you know, the logic of it. How do you move, you know, from Eastern Kentucky to, say, to where I live, you know, a huge load of contraband? Well, you're going to have to hide it in some way. And so there are interesting ways of going about doing that, some which I made up, and some which I know were actual ways that have been used in the past, that kind of thing. Almost right at the same time as this book came out, another Kentucky author did a nonfiction account called Cornbread Mafia. I don't know if anyone has heard of it, but it is a journalistic account of these guys who call themselves the Cornbread Mafia, who did basically what my Lawrence Grill does in here. And I remember when the book came out and I was reading about it. I haven't read it yet, but I was reading about it, and I was just like, if this book would have come out like 5 years before mine, I was like, it would have taken years off the writing of my own book. Because it's like all the information, you know, it's all right there. I could have just gone to that and be like, okay, so that's how they did it, you know, all right. I'll put that in my fictional county, and it'll be made up. But I had to do a lot of research and digging research, because it wasn't so readily available to find.
It's not something that people announce on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like you go to the back issues of the New York Review of Books, and they've got, you know, anything like that.
I think we have time for one more question. Well, you're... both a author and a publisher. So I heard, you know, when you were talking about how sometimes a 500-page book would be much better as a 300-page book. But how does being in the publishing world affect your writing?
It takes a lot of time away from my writing, this way I look at it. The publishing and the teaching world, I think, they both invigorate and take away from, because I think you draw from the same bits of energy that you have in yourself. It draws from the same place. You're working with language, you're working with telling stories, you're working with ways of presenting detail that are eye-catching to the readers, as she mentioned a minute ago. And so if you spend a lot of time on someone else's manuscript, then it makes it a lot harder for it to do anything that night, or to get up early in the morning and try to do the exact same thing in a different way in your own manuscript, you know? That said, what I try to do is write early in the morning before I go to work, and so my head's clear. And also, more these days, I actually do design and typesetting, so I don't have to work so much on a day-to-day level with the text, so it all works out.
Oh, I guess people are curious as what you're working on now. Yeah.
I'm a very slow writer. It'll be a while. I have what I think is another novel going, but it'll be a while before I know much more about it than that. I'm pleased that you asked me, though. Thank you.
About Peggy, a little token for our speaker?
Well, since our speaker is such a smarty that he has won so many kudos for the wonderful things he's done. He gets the very first red towel in the library. And every time you use anything that's in here, you have to say, oh, this came from Western Kentucky University Library. You lucky dog. And thank you. I've enjoyed you.
Thanks so much. Again, on behalf of the Friends of WK Libraries, our sponsor, our genial host here, Barnes & Noble, and you, our audience, we want to thank you for coming out. We hope you'll join us next week when Florencia Mayon, who's chair of the History Department at the University of Wisconsin, and has written her very first novel, which some people have been comparing to the works of Isabel Allende, will grace our presence next Thursday. And 2 weeks from today, in the orientation with the Kentucky Building, we'll be taking a look at the latest film by Morgan Atkinson, who will be premiering his documentary film on the life and times of Harlan and Anna Hubbard. So we'll hope you'll join us for those too. And thank you, and good evening.